I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. There's sort of a funny shorthand that we all use when we talk about food, I think. Right? We talk about Chinese food like that term really means something. Or French food, or Italian food, or Mexican food. I mean, what I'm saying is that we talk about food like it's bound by borders. But French food starts to look a whole lot like Spanish food when you get towards Spain. And if you're heading west in China, the Chinese food starts to taste like Turkic food. Today, we're talking to two extraordinary authors who've written books about different parts of the world, but I think are, in a sense, about the same thing. They're about how borders matter and don't matter in food. The author Reem Khasis has a gorgeous new book, The Arabesque Table. It's about modern Arab food. It's one of the most exciting cookbooks I've read in a while. The writing is smart and the recipes are thrilling. We'll talk with her later in the show. But first, we're talking with Yasmin Khan about her new book, Ripe Figs, which I devoured in a single afternoon. And you know, the pictures that cookbooks paint are sometimes the most romantic, idealized versions of the world. But Yasmin, who spent 10 years as a human rights campaigner before she started writing about food, approaches her books in a different way. She travels, she talks to people, she has lunch with them, she gets the recipes, but she walks away with a bigger sense of what the real life of regular people means. You know, it's not always happy and it's not always pretty, but the stories she tells are rich and complicated, and they're beautiful in that way. Yasmin, it's great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's so good to be back.
Yeah, I remember when the last time we saw each other in person, and you know, you were sort of sprinkling the notion that you loved it here, and I thought, oh, maybe she'd want to stick around for a while after your extended tour of the United States. But no, you went back to the UK, and then you decided actually to go to Greece and Cyprus and Turkey. And when you hear, oh, like this is a sort of a travel cookbook to Greece and Turkey and Cyprus, I think, you know, they seem like ancient places, right? And we have this sort of romantic view of these ancient traditions. But, you know, they're at the center of a very contemporary issue. So, like, how did this book end up? How different is this book when you wrote it than what you thought you'd be getting into?
Well, you know, the other element that I think brought the book together and made it so timely for this moment for me was that region has seen the biggest movement of people into Europe since the Second World War. We've seen 5 million people move through in the last 6 years, mainly, you know, as a result of the Syrian civil war, but also wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. And as I was kind of sat here and kind of watching the news and reading the stories of these migrants and refugees who are being held in camps on the edge of Europe's borders, I guess the old human rights activist in me felt propelled to kind of go out there and try and, through food stories, try and share the stories behind why people were moving. Because, you know, I come from a family of migrants, you know, both economic migrants, which is what my parents were, but also refugees fleeing political persecution in Iran. And what's always fascinated me as a, you know, a second generation immigrant is how the food that we cook tells the story not only of our day-to-day living now, but of our ancestry and of our history. And when you look at the Eastern Mediterranean, those three countries that I use as a focal point for this book, you know, the borders of those countries are as fluid as they've been contested over 3,000, you know, years. Yeah. You know, it's an area where the ancient Greeks, the ancient Persians, the Romans, the Venetians, the Ottomans, I mean, the British, you know, all colonized and conquered at some point over the last, you know, few millennia. And so as a result of that, the area has this rich tapestry of melding influences and a food culture that really reflects the constant migration through the area.
Mm-hmm. So I want to hear about some of these things that you ate and some of the meals that you shared with people. And maybe let's start with a specific place that you wrote about, because I'm fascinated by it. It's a place called Melissa. Can you tell us first where it is and really what it is?
Sure. Well, the premise behind all my books is that when I'm traveling, I like to go into people's kitchens and cook with them. And sharing meals with people is how I do my research. And so Melissa is a women's safe space, I guess, in Athens. It's a space where refugee women and migrant women can gather for everything, you know, from, you know, childcare to business classes to language development. And it was set up by Greek women who wanted to, yeah, create a space in which the many refugees who are coming through the region could gather and get support from each other. Every day they serve food so people can come. It's kind of all a free resource. And it really felt to me like this incredible space, not only of solidarity from the Greek community there, but also of exchange between the myriad of languages and cultures that were in the room when we were speaking. Yes, so that's just one example of a place that just showed to me that whilst there might be a big crisis, there's also a lot of people supporting each other.
Yeah. I want to get to another place that you wrote about that is very much about this intense sense of hospitality and how that's used in a really wonderful way. There's an amazing sounding restaurant. I think it was on the Greek island of Lesbos called Home for All. What's their story?
I mean, I've done a lot of traveling for my work, but I don't think there's a place that I've visited that has moved me as much as Home for All. And the background is quite incredible. So Home for All, well, first I'm going to set the scene in Lesbos for people who don't know. Lesbos is a beautiful Greek island situated in the Aegean Sea. You know, it's one of the most beautiful islands there. You know, there are 11 million olive trees, and that is not a misspeak. You know, it's kind of lush and forested. And it's a classic tourist destination. And Nikos and Katerina are the couple behind Home for All. And a few years ago, Nikos, he's a fisherman, and Katrina used to run the fish restaurant. Nikos went out to sea one night, and when he was there, he suddenly saw a boat coming in, and on it were people who obviously looked distressed. And he said to, you know, are you okay? And they kind of called out, yeah, we're fine. Where are you going? He asked them. And he just said, we're coming here. We're coming from Syria. We're fleeing the civil war. So he was just like in shock, you know, like just kind of meeting people. So he brought them to shore, gave them any clothes that he had, went home and spoke to his wife. And she immediately was like, well, we should take them some food. So, you know, they just got together whatever they could in their house and took it out and fed these people and spoke to them. And the couple, Nikos and Katerina, were so moved by that exchange that in the coming months, as more and more refugees started arriving in Lesbos, they decided they needed to do something. And to cut a long story short, they decided that they were going to change their restaurant, which, you know, they'd run for decades, and turn it into a nonprofit that would offer free meals every day to refugees who are living in the nearby camps. And, you know, to put this in context, the situation for the refugees when I was visiting was pretty dire. You know, the camps were overcrowded, unsanitary, quite unsafe. You know, 19,000 people living in a camp built for 3,000 people. And what Home for All does is that every day they serve a home-cooked meal on two sittings, lunch and dinner, for people in the camps. They go and pick them up and they bring them and serve them meals on white linen tablecloths with beautiful cutlery, proper glassware, serving dishes that are a mix of, you know, Greek cuisine, West Asian cuisine. And the reason they do that, I spent quite a lot of time with Katerina kind of talking to her about why they do this. You know, the reason they do that is, as she describes, you know, they wanted to offer people the space where they could eat meals in dignity. And the transference that was going on in that exchange wasn't just like, hey, I'm giving you food because you're hungry. It was, you know, you're a guest on my island and I want to treat you with the respect you deserve. And here is a delicious meal to show you that I care.
That's so profound. What did you see? What did you see on the tables? What did you see these people eating? How were they reacting to the food?
Well, I saw beautiful rice pilafs. Rice is such a unifier, I think, of food, both in the Eastern Mediterranean and in Asia. So it really kind of came together. And they had this one particular dish, which had a cheesy name, but like the sentiment was so pure that I think we can't knock it. They used to joke about it and call it love rice. And it was basically like some kind of pilaf again. I'm just thinking of this. Actually, it was just again with a lot of those warming spices again, the cumins, the cilantros, the cinnamon. And on the few times that I was there, there was a real mix. You know, we had a great lunch one day with beautiful braised lamb shanks, which is a very Greek, you know, dish with lots of oregano and thyme, you know, slow baked in the oven until the meat just kind of falls off the bone. Lamb is another unifier that brings everyone together in that region. There'd always be a fresh salad. There'd always be a pasta. They'd always say, like, basically, you know, everybody loves pasta, like noodles and a tomato sauce. So there would always be that. The meals would again reflect, I guess, how we would serve food if we were having someone round for dinner. You know, so it wouldn't be plated up. It would be family style, you know, platters per every six person. And that's how it would be served. And the place was run by volunteers. And, I've done my stints in kind of restaurants or cafes, and it would just be so interesting to see that service element going into, what in other forms could be seen as a soup kitchen, but actually just was not that at all. You know, it was a place where people could feel like they were in someone's home.
That's Yasmin Khan, author of Ripe Figs, Recipes and Stories from Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. We'll be back with more with her, and then we turn to Reem Kassis to talk about the modern Arab food in her book, The Arabesque Table. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking with Yasmin Khan right now, who wrote a cookbook about her meals with cooks, refugees, and migrants in Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus. Let's get back to that conversation. I'm going to segue into Cyprus, which is an island nation. And I think to the degree that most Americans know about Cyprus, we see it as kind of like a place of turmoil, a place of sort of a turf war between Greece and Turkey. But did you see ways in which it's clearly its own place? Did you see that in the food?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I wanted to include Cyprus because I think that when we're looking at the story of food and migration and borders in the region, mm-hmm. Cyprus actually tells the whole story.
Sure.
As you said, you know, the food in this region has got many common elements, whether it's the beautiful, earthy, peppery olive oil that is like just drizzled and poured over every dish, or whether it's the abundant use of like dill and mint and the glorious like yogurt that's so creamy and tangy that it's like famous all over the world, right? But Cyprus is fascinating because, again, an island which has just had so many conquests and occupations through it and is divided at the moment between Turkish Cypriot in the north and Greek Cypriot in the south. And yet when you travel through the island, you start seeing commonalities at the dining table where political leaders would like us to see division, you know, whether that's in the gorgeous tomato and mint stuffed grape leaves, whether it's in the delicious, you know, everybody's favorite squeaky cheese, you know, rectangles of fried halloumi, you know, whether it's in the ravioli that's stuffed with this incredible halloumi and mint. It's so good. Whether it's the love that everybody has for barbecuing meat over hot coals. And what I did on Cyprus is I cooked and ate with people on both sides of the divide, I say with inverted commas, or both sides of the UN partition line. Mm-hmm. And I really tried to kind of get down to like, what is it about your food culture that makes you different to others in the region?
Yeah.
Or maybe it doesn't. And time and again, you know, this happens when I cook with people. My experience of traveling throughout the Eastern Mediterranean is that the ordinary people in the region see more similarities between each other than any of the leaderships of Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus. Mm. And at the kitchen table, they're able to say, oh, yeah, you know, I learned this from my grandmother's neighbor who was Greek Cypriot, or, you know, my favorite place to go and get manta, which is a beautiful Turkish dumpling, is this place in, you know, the northeast of the island, which is run by this great Turkish Cypriot family. And you start seeing that the commonalities and the cultural exchange is happening all the time through the food.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, I think that there is such a thing of, you know, our identities are so wrapped up in our food and our cultures are so wrapped up in our food. And, you know, so often like our politics weaponize those things. But when you come back to the home setting, or when you come back to like a place where someone is showing you hospitality and they want to share with you what they care about, you do see it's often the same things. You know, I don't think we're going to figure out solutions to these like thorny problems at a dinner table. I think that's Pollyanna-ish, but it does sort of highlight sometimes a little bit of the arbitrariness and the absurdity of it when you see how people really live their lives. You wrote this really beautiful thing early in the book about how travel writing often, I'm not quoting, so I'm just sort of paraphrasing, but you write like travel writing sometimes feels like, oh, like the Instagram version of a life, right? It's like the most beautiful vistas. It's all the highlights. And it leads us to think, oh, that's what life is supposed to be. Or that's what life really is. But, you know, you wrote pretty frankly about how difficult parts of this journey were just for you personally, like you were going through personal stuff, and how, you know, when you recognize that, when you can see all the rougher edges, that also gives you a way to look for the beauty, I think.
Well, it's the tapestry of life, isn't it? Life is both joyful and it's sad and it's anxiety provoking and it's life affirming. It's all of those things. And I try and capture that essence in the book. You know, I think that the last year has really shown many of us the fragility that exists within the world. And it's also, I think, for many of us, and meant that we've tried to go back to the very basic things that help us feel comforted, that help us feel safe. And of course, food has been such a big part of that. You know, we've all seen everybody getting back into the kitchen and experimenting, whether it's making their sourdough or, you know, whatever the food trend was. But, you know, I went through lots of challenges whilst writing the book personally. The people I was interviewing had gone through a lot of challenges in the migration that, you know, they were being forced to take. But actually, we could all come together and express those things with the breadth of emotion that they contain whilst eating together. And I think that's very important for a number of reasons. I think that food serves many purposes. But emotional support is certainly one of them. And I think that isn't just a case of like comfort eating and like snacking on a, you know, tub of ice cream. It's about the emotional exchange that happens when you sit opposite someone and you eat with them. And it's impossible to share a meal with someone and not share a little bit of yourself. And I really hope that through the stories that I share in this book, I broaden people's understanding and awareness of the many migrants and refugees that are moving not only in the Eastern Mediterranean, but all over the world. And that through understanding the stories of why people move, perhaps we can gain a better collective empathy about how we deal with this really difficult and fraught issue.
It's wonderful. And hey, you know, this is a cookbook. Do you have a favorite recipe from this journey?
You know, I have many, and I'm not just saying that because I wrote the book, but I absolutely adored the flavors that, and the surprise elements, you know, like when I had this gorgeous pumpkin and cardamom soup made by a close Cypriot friend, delicious kind of pomegranate and sumac roast chicken inspired by a Syrian doctor I met in Lesbos. There were like delicious puddings that I tried in Cyprus, like this incredible one called Charlotta, which is a rosewater custard layered over sponge fingers and fruit soaked in a cardamom syrup.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but I think that the recipe that I probably have adopted the most is a hot yogurt soup that I learned how to make in Istanbul that is flavored with chicken broth and mint and is finished with this beautiful pul biber spiked butter. And pul biber, you guys might know it as Aleppo pepper. It's this very mild and fruity.
Super fruity, yeah.
Yeah, super fruity, quite mild chili. And there is something so soothing about that soup. I ate it with this woman who is of Kurdish, Turkish heritage, and we spoke at length about, you know, the Kurdish state and what that meant. And whilst we were doing that, we were just nourishing ourselves with this creamy, wholesome, warming hot yogurt soup.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Yasmin. It's great talking with you.
It's great talking with you.
Yasmin Khan's book is Ripe Figs, Recipes and Stories from Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. Our next conversation is with Reem Kassis. So Reem didn't set out to be a cookbook writer. She grew up in East Jerusalem in a Palestinian family. She moved to Philadelphia for college and business school, and she spent years as a consultant in the corporate world. And then she had her daughter. And she couldn't stop thinking about how her daughter would grow up so differently than her. And so she started writing for her. She started writing the recipes she remembered growing up with and the stories about her culture. And that became her first award-winning book, The Palestinian Table. Her new one is The Arabesque Table. And it's a fascinating and totally delicious read. I mean, did you know that we wouldn't have olives, olive oil, lemons, or even sugar without Arab cuisine? She takes the history of Arab flavors and shows us where they're going. Reem, it's so great to have a chance to talk with you.
Thank you, Francis. It's great to be here.
So I first want to say congratulations on your book. It is stunning. I mean, literally within minutes of me opening it, I knew I would be cooking out of this book for years to come. It's just so exciting.
That's the best thing to hear. Thank you, Francis.
Oh God. And we're going to get into all these dishes in a minute, but you know, I'm learning so much from you, like in general, in this book and in your other work about, you know, really about the Arab origins of foods that I didn't know about. So I was actually wondering if you would start today by telling us about the story of a bagel.
Sure. So like you, Francis, I was just as surprised to actually learn about the Arab origins of many of the foods we eat today. And probably the most shocking one was the bagel story. So what ended up happening was I was looking through this ancient 13th century Arabic cookbook when I came across a section in a chapter on baked breads that says ka'ik is this ring-shaped dough that is so well-known, we don't need to describe it, but here is a version of it that's interesting enough to merit a recipe. And you basically take these ring-shaped pieces of dough, you put them on a dowel, dunk them in boiling water, and then you bake them.
Oh my God,
this is the bagel. What's going on? And that took me down this rabbit hole of figuring out how the ka'ik was the precursor to the bagel. And the story is fascinating, and it almost like the entire universe of culinary diffusion in the story of a single piece of bread. But basically what happened really was the Arabs, when they took over Bari in Italy, and it became their principal stronghold in the Middle Ages from where they influenced European cuisine.
Yeah, wild.
They probably introduced ka'ik or a version of it there. And then later on, there was a woman from Bari who went to Poland And there she married into the royal family. And Jewish historians who traced the bagel to 16th century Poland actually traced the original version of it to the royal family where this lady from Bari had married into. So you start to see how items of food travel across time and place, and you end up with a version that is probably different from the original one.
Sure.
And definitely associated with Jewish cuisine. And to me, figuring out or coming across this Arab version of it was very interesting, but I still don't see that it detracts from its valued position in Jewish cuisine. So
it was
a beautiful way to see how food can become cross-cultural over time and be important to different people in different cultures in unique ways.
Yeah. You know, and I think that I'm fascinated by this story and stories like it, right? And I think, you know, for a lot of people, you know, the reality is finding the exact origins of dishes is always complicated.
It's dicey,
right?
Yes.
Unless it's like, here is the first Oreo, because, and we know that because someone invented it and they named it and trademarked
right.
it. Although apparently, I guess like the Hydrox predated the Oreo, but whatever.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So maybe, yeah, there actually, that's the whole story in a nutshell. It's like, oh, who invented it? Who stole it? Whatever.
Right.
But I think people are honed in on these questions because they want to say, oh, we own this food, right? Mm-hmm. This thing is ours.
Right.
But hearing you talk about it and hearing you describe it and certainly reading your writing on it, learning about the history of food is just as much about learning how like porous borders are when it comes to food. You know, we can try to say, well, this started here, so we own it. But the reality is like it's always evolving. It's always moving. People move. Cultures move literally and figuratively. So like it's always a form of evolution. And
true.
That's kind of how you have to look at it. Right?
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more, Francis. And that's probably one of the points I wanted to convey most with the book is that food is inherently cross-cultural. At the same time, it may be important to defining a national identity, and those things do not need to be mutually exclusive. Because the problem happens when we start saying, you know, this is authentic and this belongs to this people or this nation. And really, if by authentic we mean something that is void of external influence, then those things just do not exist. Mm. And the lens with which we look at cuisine is partially flawed because our time frame is so short. You know, we look back 200 years and we think, oh, you know, Italian food is, I don't know, pasta or lasagna or pizza, things that are heavily tomato-based. Same with Arab cuisine. You think tomato is a big component of it. But you'd probably be surprised to find out tomatoes didn't make their way to Italy till the 18th century and to the Arab world till the 19th century. So if you go further back, you realize the food we used to eat did not look anything like the food that we eat today. Now, with that said, I think the crux of the issue is oftentimes people are trying to put stakes in the ground and claim ownership, not because of the food itself, but because of systemic underlying issues that food represents for them.
Sure. And,
you know, as a Palestinian, I understand this when we discuss issues of culinary appropriation. And I've said this multiple times. It's never about hummus. It's never about the chickpea. It's about what does this symbolize for me and for my people? And I think you see this regardless of the cuisine and regardless of the conflict that is going on around a specific dish or a specific national cuisine.
Yeah. Yeah. When we get to the place where we're arguing about who owns what dish or who owns what recipe, it's not to say those aren't important conversations, because they certainly are, but they're, like you said, they're symbolic in a sense. They're more symptoms than the cause of any kind of dispute or a conflict. It's like, oh, there's a bigger thing happening.
It's almost like a framing issue.
Yeah. But to get back to the food,
right?
And just the tastiness of it, because I'm so excited by that piece of your book as well. You have, I mean, just so many amazing sounding recipes in this book. I'd love for you to walk us through some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the first, which I think really speaks to this phenomenon you're talking about, is a cousin of, please correct my pronunciation, mutabal, M-U-T-A-B-A-L.
Oh, yeah. Very good pronunciation. Yes, mutabal.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So mutabal is, it's sort of like baba ganoush, but made with tahini, right? So it's roasted pureed eggplant dip.
Correct. So mutabbal, is the word itself means seasoned or spiced, and it's used to refer to almost any paste made with tahina in it. It can be eggplant, it can be beetroot, it can be anything. But generally, when you say mtabbal, most people are referencing the eggplant one.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for that lesson. And you wrote about a Sudanese version of this dish. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
So this is, I love peanut butter, and this is probably one of my favorite dishes in the book. And it was almost a revelation to think we can use peanut butter the same way we use tahina. And that's essentially what this mutabbal that you're referencing is. Mm. It takes eggplants, and they're sautéed or fried as opposed to being char-grilled the way you would do the traditional one. And then you use the peanut butter as the binding paste for it. And you'd be surprised, but it's such a perfect match. I think the nuttiness, which is probably why tahina works with it as well, but it has a certain sweetness to it that tahina doesn't have. And I think combining those together and the fact that there's tomatoes, it's one of those spreads that you make it and you probably should hide it if you're making it for guests, because otherwise you will finish it before they arrive.
But it's so interesting because, like, Sudan, you know, that's not a sesame growing place. And as you write in your book, I think, what is the name for peanut is?
In Ful Sudani.
Yeah.
which literally means Sudanese beans.
Yeah.
it speaks to how food is a function of geography. I mean, this is why if you go to any country and you look within it, the cuisine is different if you go from north to south or east to west or city to country. And Sudan, they don't have sesame seeds, they have peanuts, so why not? They use it actually substantially in their cuisine, not just in this particular dish.
We're talking to Reem Kassis, author of The Arabesque Table, about modern Arab food. We'll be back with more with her in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking with Reem Kassis, author of The Arabesque Table, about where Arab food has been and where it's going. Let's get back to her. Here I'm going to go to another eggplant dish that also sounds super great. You have a broiled eggplant salad with sumac chicken and pine nuts.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear you tell us about how you actually came up with this recipe, because this is not a traditional one. I think you made this recipe up, but tell us about where it came from.
So this dish actually came about because I'm friends with a Thai lady. Her name is Nok, and many of you probably know her by now. She owns one of the most amazing restaurants I've ever been to that serves Thai food. And she's a good friend of mine and had invited us over to her house long before she opened up her restaurant. And one of the dishes she served up was these eggplants that had been broiled and peeled. And then she had topped them with shrimp and chicken and boiled eggs and peanuts and coriander. And to me, it was a revelation that this ingredient that in our cuisine is used in very particular ways had never received that kind of treatment. It was almost like a vessel for everything that was on top of it rather than a primary component.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, you know, shrimp probably is not going to work for us, but chicken does. And, you know, sumac is a natural ingredient that goes very well with chicken. It's just they're a combination that's common in our cuisine. And
it's
in
like
terms of,
and
yes, it's floral. It's essentially the skin of a berry. And so those two things go well together. And the crunch pine nuts are the go-to in Arab cuisine. And then when it came to the dressing, hers was fish sauce and sugar and lime. And it's just so pungent and beautiful. But I wanted it to have this particular dish to have a more Arab flair to it. And so we went for the traditional lemon, olive oil, salt, and I used parsley instead of coriander. And, you know, when I first wanted to try it out, I was like, I wonder if this is going to work. And even if it does, it's not going to taste as good. And I was surprised. I was very pleasantly surprised with the outcome. And again, you see, you know, it's not a traditional dish by any stretch. And it points to how we can learn from other cultures.
Yeah, and it has to look so stunning, right? You have this whole eggplant that you broiled until it's soft and that's laid on the platter, and then you top it with all this beautiful chicken and herbs and shallots and tomatoes, and you have all this dressing on top. It has to look glorious.
It does. I mean, it looks like you have jewels sprinkled all over a bright, lightly colored eggplant.
It's beautiful. I want to go to another one. Mm-hmm. First, can you tell us what the typical or traditional version of fata is? Did I pronounce that one right?
Yes, fate. Perfect.
Fate. Okay. Because so, I love this dish.
I love fate too, and it's such a versatile dish. Literally, what fate means is to break and soak in something. Mm. And historically, it referred to usually stale bread, or like not stale, but leftover bread that was torn into pieces and then topped with either some kind of vegetable or some kind of meat cooked a certain way. Sometimes it would include grains or rice as well. And then it's topped with a sauce. Mm. As for the origins and why it came about, it's probably a combination of two things. One of them is this perception that you just don't waste anything. So if you have leftover bread, then you use it in this method. The other one is also born out of austerity, which is we want to bulk up a meal. If I have some meat mm-hmm. and I need to feed a whole family, you know, adding bread to the dish is an easy way to do it. Nowadays, it's seen as a very, you know, celebratory or festive dish that you often invite people over and prepare. And the options are endless. You start with a layer of toasted pita bread. And of course, nowadays, you know, you have the option to use pita chips. And then you come with the toppings. So in the book, there's several options and different variations on them. And once you've done that, then you put a dressing on the top. And I don't mean dressing in the traditional sense of a salad dressing. This is more like a sauce, almost like you would put on pasta. There's a substantial amount of it. Oftentimes, it's a yogurt or a tahini-based one, but there are other versions as well.
Yeah.
Which one did you like the best, Francis?
Well, I mean, I'm a little obsessed with the idea in your book of doing this, but instead of using chickpeas, using like roasted or sautéed shiitake mushrooms.
Ah, yes. I do like that recipe too. So this one, again, I came across it in a restaurant in Boston called Muna. And I remember first thinking, oh God, why are they messing with the traditional fete? It's good enough as it is. And then when the dish came out, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought, wow, this really tastes very good. And who would have thought that shiitake mushroom would have this very strong and pungent flavor? I thought it would be more bland and but mixed with the chickpeas and the pomegranate molasses. And then for the herb, they use dill instead of, you know, normally you would just garnish with parsley.
Oh, interesting.
Here, the dill also added a certain element and walnuts. And it blew my mind. It just tasted so good. It was vegetarian, which is a plus. But at the same time, it had the heft of one that is prepared with meat.
Yeah. I want to get to another mushroom dish you have here.
Let's do it.
The mushroom shawarma.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, shawarma is obviously such an iconic item in Arab cuisine. It has traveled the world. Like in Mexico, you have like tacos al pastor, which you know, I think people credit to Lebanese immigrants who brought shawarma with them. Mm-hmm. So tell us what traditional shawarma is and actually the origins of it as well.
So shawarma itself, the word that's used in Arabic, is a derivative of a Turkish word, which means rotating. And traditionally, shawarma is pieces of meat, probably lamb historically, that is layered on this rotating skewer. And it turns basically because the heat source around it is what's cooking it. And then you shave the edges of it as it cooks.
Yeah.
And it's a very fatty cut of meat.
It's like such an awesome technique.
It's so good.
Really one of the classics.
But I think nowadays, one of the things that is very recognized about shawarma is the spicing, right? So if you get a shawarma sandwich, if you go to a restaurant, oftentimes you might not see this rotating spit. You might not be served in the traditional way, but the spicing has a unique flavor to it. And they even sell in shops a spice mixture called shawarma blend. And I'm sure it varies from vendor to vendor and family to family, but there are a few components of it that stay the same. And at home, obviously, you slice it very thin while it's partially frozen and then fried. I don't have a rotating spit at home. But the mushroom, I thought, what's something, again, that's meaty, that has the texture of meat and part of that flavor, but at the same time also can hold up to the heft of frying. And I tried the mushrooms and I ended up also adding onions to it just to bulk it up and give it a bit more of the meaty flavor. And it worked.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing another version of it with squid in the book.
Oh, cool. How would you describe the primary flavors of that spice mix?
It's very earthy and pungent. So there's cumin, there's fenugreek, there's black pepper, there's some paprika in it. And then it's also got some sourness to it, which can come from lemon or vinegar or sumac, depending on how you're marinating the meat or the vegetable that you're cooking. But it's a very pungent, earthy, meaty flavor.
Yeah. I want to get to a couple more things with you. And actually, these are sort of like polar opposites, but I want to talk about toum, and then I want to get to dessert or sweets. So okay. Toum is something that I love. You know, I love the flavor of garlic. And toum is like one of the most intense and purest expressions of garlic I have ever seen in any cuisine. Uh-huh. Tell us about toum.
So toum just means garlic in Arabic. And you probably noticed this trend. Our dishes are very creatively named by the primary ingredient in them. But it looks like mayonnaise when you look at it. And the texture is very similar to mayonnaise as well. But it doesn't have eggs in it. It's made just by garlic. And depending on who's making it, it will either be bulked up with egg whites or with copious amounts of oil. So I make it with cornstarch.
Okay.
Because what you're looking for is this fluffy, I mean, it's like a mayonnaise texture. That's the easiest way to describe it. At the same time, if I'm making it, I want it to last in the fridge. So I don't want to make it with egg whites because they would be raw inside it and then you can use it for a day at most. At the same time, I don't want to be making it with like 2 cups of oil. You know, as much as I love it, I don't think my waistline does. So the cornstarch was a happy medium. There are people who use mashed potato, but that does dilute the flavor of the garlic. And so this way of making the sauce, you basically get this thickened paste by mixing cornstarch and water, almost like this puddingy texture. And then the garlic will flavor it, and you don't need that much garlic. And you can totally start out with less and start increasing it to your liking. And then you do add a bit of oil to emulsify it, and it comes together so quickly, just in a very small blender, or, you know, I use those mini choppers. You don't need something super sophisticated for it. But it's so useful in the kitchen. I mean, my favorite way to have it is with grilled chicken and tomatoes and pickles wrapped up in pita bread. But you could also use it in salad dressings. You know, you could thin it out with some lemon or vinegar, and you have a very garlicky salad dressing. You can mix it in with pasta. You can use it as a spread for your sandwiches. When I remember I was living in Jordan at one time, and it was served so simply, just smeared on slices of tomatoes and sprinkled with sumac. And it was the perfect, you know, it wasn't even an appetizer. It was literally what they served you when you sat down before you even placed your order.
You know, it took me a while to learn to, I've never had it at home. Because I've never made it and never, you know, bought a jar of it. I've always had it, as you said, like often, you know, as a condiment in a sandwich. And raw garlic is, you know, it's delicious. It's aromatic. It's fragrant. It's something that I, you know, it took me a long time to learn how to sort of control in cooking. Like often if I use raw garlic in a dish, I'm like, oh man, that's too much. Or, oh, I can't taste it. You know, like for me, like it took me a while to sort of find like where the sweet spots would be. And I think the toum is so cool because it's like this very distributable flavor of raw garlic.
Absolutely.
It's like you can use a little dab of it. You can add more. You can spread it. You can mix in other things. It just becomes this very controllable thing. Or if you want it to just be like totally out of control, then you're just like, oh, I'm using it like mayonnaise and boom. Like
exactly. And the oil also tames it down, Francis. Like it's not just garlic by itself. And oftentimes if we're making salads like tabbouleh or anything that has garlic in it, we often, at least my mother has always told me to do this, you always put the olive oil on that ingredient, especially if you're not mixing it straight away. It prevents, you know, the smell from getting into the kitchen, and it just safeguards it and makes it more mild. And I think this happens definitely here in this sauce. So you get the wonderful parts of the raw garlic without the very aggressive hints of it.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so because we're talking about Arab food, and really it's because of Arabs that we have sugar, right? Like Like, they really were the people who brought sugar around the world.
Originally from beets as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sugar beets.
Thank you for beets and sugar.
Well, it's, yeah. But let's not get into that history. We'll be on, you know, we'll be talking for 10 hours.
So I think we have to talk about a sweet dish. What's your favorite sweet recipe in the book?
Oh, God, those questions are always hard. It's like picking out your favorite kid, right?
Oh, no. They don't have emotions. It's fine. The recipes won't come back.
They don't care.
They won't go into therapy years later.
No? Oh, good to know. So, look, they're all great. But if I did have to pick one, I would probably pick the halawa, which, if you think that doesn't qualify as a dessert, I will pick out a cake for you. But for me, this was a revelation when I figured out how to make it.
Yeah, what is it, first of all?
So halawa is the Arabic way of saying halva.
Okay.
And it's actually, again, it's also why in India people say halva for all sweets. It's derived from the Arabic word. Halawa just simply means something that is sweet. So this one is made from three very simple ingredients. It's powdered sugar, powdered milk, and tahine. And then whatever topping or garnish you want. And the reason I love it is once I moved to the US, I could no longer find the same kind of halawa that I could get back home. And the traditional way of making it includes using soapwort and glucose. And it's a very complicated process and difficult to replicate at home. Okay. And oftentimes what you find in stores is too sugary or not the right texture or too crumbly. And this particular recipe gives you the texture and the flavor of it in something that is incredibly easy to make.
Okay.
But I also love it because you can turn it into truffles. So you don't have to eat it just as halawa, like in a piece of bread. You can coat it in melted chocolate.
Oh, cool.
And garnish it with like pistachio or rose petals. And both of those recipes are in there actually. So for me, it's, you know, it's a sweet treat, less so than a dessert. But it's got the best elements of everything. It's nutty. It's a little salty, but it's very sweet, but it's not cloyingly sweet. And so
yeah,
it's probably why it's one of my favorites.
And tell us about the texture.
So you want it to have a bite to it. It's not supposed to melt like a praline would in your mouth. But once you bite it, you don't want to, you know how sometimes, what's cotton candy, you know how it gets really sugary and stuck in your teeth? You don't want that. And that's what ends up happening with a lot of the store-bought ones. So here you want something that you can bite into almost like a fudge. But then once you start chewing it, it melts in your mouth.
Yeah, kind of dissolves.
You know, there's no crystallized sugar, nothing. It just dissolves.
Yeah, the closest analog I can think of is like the inside of a Butterfinger bar.
You know how long it's been since I've had a Butterfinger bar? Now you're going to make me go out to the supermarket and get one just so I can figure it out.
it's like kind of crisp, but like once you realize it's crisp, it's gone. Like it just kind of melts and dissolves. And then you have just that beautiful nutty flavor. Cool. I'm gonna try your version. I'm psyched for it.
Yes.
Well, Reem, this has been so fun. I mean, I could really geek out on this food with you all day long. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been fun for me too. I wish we could share a meal, but soon.
One day soon. One day soon.
Thank you, Francis.
Reem Cassis is the author of The Arabesque Table. Her first book is The Palestinian Table. Reem left us with the recipe she talked about, shiitake mushroom fateh. It's topped with walnuts and pomegranate molasses and yogurt and tahini. It sounds incredible. You can find it at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it. Hey, we didn't get to your cooking questions this week, but please do keep them coming. Record them as voicemails on your phone, and you can email them to us at contact@splendidtable.org. We'll talk to you next week. Hey, you know, you can always download past episodes and take us with you on your walks or in your car. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we have a great free weekly recipe newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. You can sign up for it at splendidtable.org. APM Studios are run by Lily Kim, Alex Shafford, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer. The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper, and it's made every week by technical producer Jenny Lukey, associate producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.